Hello, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and on the line with me today is Dan Pink. Dan is a former White House speechwriter, and he's the author of Free Agent Nation, which was published in 1997, a book about the growing ranks of people who work for themselves, a topic that I can relate to. He's a writer for Wired Magazine, Fast Company, The New York Times, Washington Post, New Republic, Harvard Business Review, and Salon. He advises startup and Fortune 100 companies alike on recruiting business, recruiting and business trends and work practices. And he is also an analyst and commentator for CNBC, ABC, and NPR. And today we're going to be talking about Dan's latest book entitled A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age. Dan, I'd like to welcome you to the call.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
Yes. Well, so I think most people listening to this recording are going to have heard of the Industrial Age and the Information Age, but I think few have heard of the Conceptual Age. What's going on here with these different ages?
Well, I mean, I think one reason that people haven't heard of the Conceptual Age is that we're at the early days of that. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we go through these eras of economic advantage, of competitive logic, and in the Industrial Age, what it took to get ahead was basically a strong back and a willingness to follow rules. It was an age of mass production workers, people doing routine physical labor, and that was the source of how to get ahead in America, and also was a source of advantage for companies. Then things started changing. People got wealthier. Technology improved, which made manufacturing more productive, which means you needed fewer people. But we also got richer, so people wanted things other than goods. They wanted services and experiences and all that stuff. Plus, we found that folks overseas could produce manufactured goods for a lot less, in many cases, than we could produce them here. And so gradually, the source of economic advantage shifted again to the information age, and that was an age of what Peter Drucker famously called knowledge workers. Knowledge workers are people who are relying on a keen, a kind of analytical, logical, school book set of abilities, SAT abilities, spreadsheet abilities, accountants and lawyers and engineers. Well, now we're in the midst of another shift, and what's happening now are the three forces, which maybe we can talk about in a bit. Abundance, Asia, and automation are nudging us out of that information age in much the same fashion that we left the industrial age into what I think is a new era of competitive logic, economic advantage, career logic as well. And that's what I call the conceptual age, which is an age not of knowledge workers or of mass production workers, but of creators and of empathizers, of people who can do things that people overseas can't do cheaper, that software can't do faster, and that satisfies some of the emotional and aesthetic and spiritual demands of a very prosperous age. And so it's an age of where the central economic figures are going to be folks like designers and product development people and those who have the sales function and entrepreneurs and nurses and caregivers. And it's going to be a little bit less, significantly less, about sorts of high SAT engineers, accountants, and lawyers.
Well, and how far are we from being in the middle of that?
Well, it's unclear what the middle is. I mean, what we have now is we have you have to think of it as a Polaroid photograph that's developing. There's some parts of it that are really coming very clearly into focus. There are other parts that are still a little bit blurry. But already in America today, you have more people who work in art, entertainment, and design than work as lawyers, accountants, or auditors. You have the greatest demand, the greatest professional demand in this country, isn't for engineers, isn't for accountants, it's for nurses. Again, a profession that is difficult to outsource and difficult to automate. You have places like General Motors and Microsoft going to recruit sculptors at the Rhode Island Institute, the Rhode Island School of Demand. The Rhode Island School of Design, which is becoming the Rhode Island School of Demand, because everybody demands the sort of artistic sensibilities that are being put in place there. So, you know, throughout the economy, you can see the stirrings of this. You can see it in the success of. I know that you have a, your audience consists of a lot of people in organizations who are thinking about not only the logic of individual careers, but also what it means for the entire organization. And you see the success of companies like Apple, which is built on design and emotion and that kind of sensibility. You see it in the success of a company like Target, which, again, is competing with Walmart, not on price, this very kind of left-brain dimension, but more on, much more on design, a right-brain dimension. You see it in the success of firms, of companies like Whole Foods, which is catapulted out of a very painfully low-margin business, retail grocery, by appealing to some of these more right-brain sensibilities.
It seems, Dan, though, that the entire system that we've created around educating people and tapping into their abilities is based around the information age. Yesterday I spoke with 400 teachers, and many of them would complain of the forces that act on them from the state level, saying, you know, test scores, and they're graded on their how well their school performs on these on what, you know, the SAT type of knowledge. What do you see there as far as how do we make a shift from a system that focuses on that to the skills that you're talking about are needed in the conceptual age?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very tough question, and I think you've got it spot on that a lot of our systems are utterly misaligned to dealing with this. I mean, what I'm arguing in this book, A Whole New Mind, is that the scales are tilting away from what you might call left-brain abilities. SAT abilities, spreadsheet abilities, zero in on the right answer abilities. Those things still matter. They still absolutely 100% matter. But today they're necessary and no longer sufficient. And what matters as much, if not more, are the set of abilities we've often overlooked and undervalued. Artistry, empathy, seeing the big picture, inventiveness, caring for others. And I think that you're absolutely right that our school systems are geared only toward that one dimension of what it means to be smart, only that one dimension, indeed, of what it means to be human. And I think in many cases they're going in exactly the opposite direction from where the economy is going, with, as you suggest, this obsession over standardized tests, with cutting arts programs and cutting drama programs and cutting music programs. And it is, I mean, I can see, you know, teachers being extraordinarily frustrated here, because this is not being done by teachers or even by principals, is being done by legislators who are imposing these restrictions on people. So I think, you know, that's one area, and I don't have an answer for it. I mean, I think what people do these kind of jerry-rigged workarounds to try to develop these abilities in spite of what's going on in the schools. And another reason people end up developing these abilities in spite of school is that the abilities that I think matter most. And in the book, I talk about six key abilities that I think are going to really matter in this dawning age. Things like design and storytelling and empathy and play. They're the sorts of things that people do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation. They're things that people actually want to do. And so that makes it more likely that people will actually develop the skills and actually put them into practice.
Well, I'd like you to share the three forces that you had mentioned that are moving us to the conceptual age. I mean, and taking a step back to these legislators that are, I think their intentions are good. The idea is that if someone does well on a SAT test or, you know, a very left brain type of skill development, is that that's somehow going to position them for success here in the States. But
right.
You're suggesting that's not the case.
I'm suggesting that it's not the case. I'm suggesting absolutely that everybody needs to develop those sorts of left brain abilities. That only gets you to the table today, because those kinds of left brain abilities are no longer sufficient to get you ahead in the economy. At the same time, those kinds of left brain abilities are an incomplete account of what it actually means to be human. They're not enough, also, not only for succeeding in the economy, they're not enough for leading a rich and fulfilling and interesting life. And yet we've become, as you suggest, in the school system, obsessed over SATs and standardized testing and No Child Left Behind. And in some sense, we are fighting the last war.
So it gets us to the table because Asia. What's going on in Asia that's causing us to live in a world that's flat?
Well, that's one of the three. Asia is one of the three forces that is, again, tilting the scales away from these left brain abilities ever more toward these right brain abilities. And by Asia, I mean outsourcing now, offshoring of white collar work to lower wage countries like India, Philippines, Eastern Europe. What's happening now, we've heard a lot about offshoring, and the truth about offshoring, Tom, is that it's really overhyped in the short term and really underhyped in the long term. Over time, certain types of work in this country is going to disappear, and it's work that is routine, work that can be reduced to a script, to a spec sheet, to a set of rules, to a set of instructions. That kind of work, and it's brain power work, it's white collar work that requires, you know, some brain ability, significant brain ability in many cases, financial analysis, accounting, certain kinds of computer programming. That kind of work, if it's routine, will over time disappear from this country in much the same way that routine mass production work has disappeared from this country over the last 50 years. And what that means is that if you want to survive in the economy today, you have to do something that these talented knowledge workers overseas can't do cheaper. And that turns out to be the sorts of work that isn't this kind of spreadsheet routine analytical work, but tends to be more about artistry and empathy and the sorts of things that are harder to routinize.
So, and you talk about abundance as well as a force that's moving us in that direction. It's clear to me how Asia, mm-hmm. The offshoring, you know, I could, if I'm having my taxes done by H&R Block, someone in India might be actually completing that.
Right, exactly.
So tell me about abundance.
Well, let's go to, if we can for a second, let's go to automation.
Okay.
Because it's sort of operating in a similar fashion to Asia. What's happening now, in much the same fashion, is that last century we saw that machines could, in many cases, replace human muscle. And this century we're seeing that software can replace a lot of the functionings of the, or at least augment many of the functionings of the left side of the brain, the left hemisphere of the brain, the side that is rational, analytical, sequential. And so if you're an accountant, you face competition from a chartered accountant in India who makes $500 a month, but you also face competition from TurboTax. Again, there are certain kinds of white-collar professions that we thought would never be pressured by automation are finding that software, certain kinds of legal software, certain kinds, very, very early stages, certain kinds of medical diagnosis software, and certain kinds of financial analytical software can do the kind of work that human beings used to do, and they can do it just as well. And when that happens, again, you have to be able to do something that the software can't do faster and just as well. Now, to get to your point about it, so you can see those two pressures. Again, you have to be able to do something that can't be outsourced or automated. Now, at the same time, to pick up on your question about abundance, at the same time what we have going on is we live, and we often lose sight of this in the United States, we live in, I think elite opinion loses sight of this in the United States, we live in an astonishingly prosperous country, deep into the middle class. The standard of living in this country is breathtaking. As a result of that, I think people, you also have a demographic force. You have 7 out of 8 Americans who weren't alive during the Great Depression. And so you have this, you know, and I have, as a former speechwriter, I traffic in startling factoids, but you have, you know, just an array of data and factoids that show just how prosperous this society is. Let's take automobiles. 100 years ago, automobiles were a rich person's toy. Today, in this country, we have more cars than we have licensed drivers.
Wow.
It's a greater than 1-to-1 ratio between cars and people to drive them. I mean, even something like, and this is my favorite startling factoid, or one of my favorite startling factoids at least, you have think about an industry like self-storage, okay? A self-storage industry is an industry devoted entirely to excess. It exists only because of excess. There were not self-storage facilities in the Depression. There were not self-storage facilities when we were just developing a consumer economy. Those things emerged when people had so much stuff, it grew too large to house it. And so
right.
An entire industry developed around housing the excess stuff. Well, self-storage in America is a $17 billion a year business. The self-storage industry is larger than the motion picture business. That's what I mean by abundance. And abundance changes the game. Here's how. If you want to sell a product, a service, an experience, you cannot sell something that is merely functional, that's merely rational, that merely satisfies the functional needs. You can do that, but what you're doing in that case, in a business sense, is you're competing solely on price. And that puts you in this kind of economy into basically a downward death spiral. So you have to compete and appeal to consumers, to appeal to customers on a different dimension, on an aesthetic dimension, on an emotional dimension, on a spiritual dimension. So it's why you can go into Target and you can get designer toilet brushes, designer kitchen utensils, because even the most mundane utilitarian objects have been transformed into objects of desire. And this is why design, again, much more of a right brain than a left brain ability, although it's really a whole-minded ability. It's about utility and significance. It's about function and transcendence, which is why design, to my mind, is as important a business capability today as knowing Microsoft Excel. I mean, if you want to succeed in business today, you must have a design sensibility. You must understand design. Period. And that's only true because of abundance.
So back in the day, the Ford Model T, you can have any color you want as long as it's black.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we moved from there to we got the function thing down, point A to point B, the car works. And now that's no because I guess we're such a wealthy society, we've got to have a car that not only works, but everybody wants one that looks good.
Right, and it feels good, and that and that's because, deep into the class structure in this country, one can find a car that can get you from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a little bit of discretionary income, people want a car that does something more than that, and it's true of all kinds of products. I mean, you even have, General Motors, which obviously is taking a beating right now. Because of healthcare costs and whatnot. You have one of the top guys at General Motors saying that General Motors, he thinks, is in the art business, that it's art, entertainment, and mobile sculpture that coincidentally happens to provide transportation.
And it used to be that engineers or people with strong left brain capabilities were needed to get to that place to create a car that always worked when you turned it on.
Right.
Now they need to find, GM needs to find people. They've mastered that aspect. Now they've got to find people with right brain skills to make it appealing.
That's a big part of it. Now, there's some people who would question whether GM has mastered the engineering part, but certainly the engineering part has become necessary but no longer sufficient because, we can pretty much make a car that can get somebody from point A to point B without the wheels falling off. And that's a great thing. That itself is a glorious achievement. That is not a mundane thing. But again, in the constant churn of the economy, people get used to that pretty quickly and they want something a little bit more, which is why GM is recruiting sculptors at the Rhode Island School of Design.
Mm. So in your book, one of the great things I think about your book that I like so much is that you offer not only I would guess the first third of it is providing the concept behind the argument,
right,
that you're giving, and then a good portion of your book says, okay, here are some skills that you need as we enter this conceptual age. So and you mentioned a handful of them at the beginning of the conversation. You list six. Design, story, symphony, empathy, play, and meaning. And I'd like you, if you could, many of the people listening to this recording are interested, I'm sure, in this subject for themselves and how they're going to move into this age. And also, what does this mean for groups of people, and how can a team, what does this mean for an organization? Can you share some thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, on one level, organizations and teams are fundamentally collections of individuals.
Yes.
So as individuals begin to be forced to master these new set of abilities, that's going to change the dynamics of teams. But if you look at, in some sense, teams are more important than ever before because it's easier to segment in certain functions and just ship them away. And mm-hmm. The functions that remain are the more high-concept, high-touch functions that often require some amount of collaboration, that require some amount of teamwork, as you know. And so
Touch on that. You said high-concept and high-touch. What does that mean? Those are skills you say you need to flourish in the conceptual age, right?
Well, what I mean, it's sort of a contrast to high-tech, High concept is the ability to detect patterns, to combine disparate things into something new, to craft a compelling narrative. High touch is physical presence, empathy, understanding people, meaning, social skills, etc. And those are, the kind of things that are difficult to outsource and difficult to automate. And so, you know, you're going to have, let's take design, for instance. Some design is done individually, but a lot of design is done in teams. And you want every team member to have a very sharp design sensibility. Let's take something, an ability such as empathy, which is an ability I think economically we haven't taken seriously enough. Empathy turns out to be, number one, it's just a good thing. I mean, it makes people better. It makes human beings better. But it also turns out to be a valuable business ability, and that in something like design, because in order to be a good designer, you have to be empathic with the people for whom you're designing.
Mm.
At the same time, you have to be empathic with your fellow teammates. You have to get along with them. You have to understand where you're coming from. I think that the ability of symphony is a very, very important ability in teams, because symphony is my term for the ability to put things together, to connect the dots, to see the big picture, to combine disparate things into something that the world didn't know it was missing. And in teams, symphony is symphony in the literal sense consists of a variety of individuals who collectively are doing something where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yes.
And so and the key thing about symphony is perspective and different vantage points and multidisciplinary, and so having a team that is itself symphonic is the kind of team that's really going to rock and roll.
And so how does a team make that shift or begin to really capitalize on their right brain? I mean, someone who's leading a team, and I would suspect that, you know, most teams are not really tapping into all the resources that are there. Because maybe they don't think like this. Maybe they don't think that the right brain is what I need to get access to. Because most people are again, it's from an early age we begin to value left brain skills, and then someone ends up as a manager of a team, and they themselves say, well, this is what my parents always thought and teachers always thought that this is what's valuable. So how does someone make that jump to say, okay, left brain to right brain?
I think it's difficult. And I think it requires managers and team leaders who really get it and who really have that kind of sensibility and who are willing to assemble teams where there are a variety of abilities, a variety of talents, a variety of strengths. Because in that diversity, in that multi-pronged approach, in those multiple disciplines are going to come big ideas, new ideas, great inventions, and the ability to detect patterns. But a lot of it does, Tom, as you suggest, hinge on the sensibility of that one individual who is assembling the team or who is leading the team. And that is the sort of change that doesn't necessarily come easy. It doesn't come easily because, again, I mean, I'm basically just echoing what you're saying, because the folks who have risen to these higher levels have generally in the past risen because of their facility with these more left-brain abilities.
Hmm.
That's what they've always been rewarded for, so that's what they're going to continue to put forth. Now, there is, the one antidote for that is the elixir called competition. So you have, companies, organizations that end up floundering because they're relying too much on these left brain sorts of abilities and not enough on these right brain sorts of abilities. I mean, I think Walmart is actually a fairly interesting example of that. Now, no one is going to be crying for Walmart's, dented place in the economy. I mean, Walmart is a huge powerhouse, but
yes.
Walmart right now is understanding the limits of this purely kind of left brain supply chain management, drive the price down approach to business. First of all, there's a political backlash to them. Second of all, I mean, the consumers are, even though they're dealing with a mid-range consumer, even those kinds of customers want something more than simply the barest product at the barest discount. And so Walmart, my God, I mean, this is, a sea change in America. Walmart is actually going to start, according to some recent news reports, start looking to have more designed products. Walmart is even going to start selling organic food.
Really?
Yeah. That was in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal sometime this week. You know, because again, Walmart is facing the kinds of pressures. Because again, you can only discount so much, and then consumers are saying, "Well, what have you done for me lately?"
Right.
And I think it's good. I think for low income customers, you know, I think it's fantastic that they can go into Walmart and get something for a buck cheaper than they can get it somewhere else. But ultimately, that sort of approach has its limits, and this is why if you look at the recent earnings reports of Target and Walmart, that Target is really doing exceptionally well, and Walmart is struggling a little bit. Now, when Walmart struggles, it's not like other companies struggling. Walmart,
right.
Again, Walmart is still a behemoth, and you know, makes it a gigantic amount of money and has a huge impact on the economy. But it's a giant that is stumbling a little bit, and I think it's stumbling because it's looking around, seeing itself in an era of slightly different competitive advantage.
So, when you talk, it reminds me of left brain to right brain. I'm reminded of the Enron story of it seems like there's a group of really strong left brain capable people. There's a documentary out or a book out called The Smartest Guys in the Room.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. Is it good?
I haven't, but I'd like to see it. But it reminds me that here's a group of people doing some creative things, but not in the most ethical way. I know that some of those people just were not challenged by their peers, as they were doing this creative type of whatever they were doing. So
I have to say on Enron, I think, over the long haul, fraud doesn't work in the conceptual age or in the information age.
Well, I think what's interesting is that as we begin to value more of this, the right brain, I think that there are people out there that are probably going to struggle with, well, how do you do this? What's the best way to manage this new commodity? And what I love about it is that it's going to require a huge shift from anybody who's in the education field, and then also anybody who's managing a group of people. No longer is it just sufficient to say, gosh, they can't just hire on a let's see what your grades are.
Right, exactly.
What does a 4.0 really mean?
Right, and I think I think, again, in some cases it's a case of a pendulum swinging the other way, but if you look at certain kinds of recruiting has become, not all of it, but certain kinds of recruiting has swung too much in the high-tech direction, where basically all they do is take a bunch of resumes and use scan them in and use a bunch of keywords to filter things out and don't have a sense of the nuance for the person. I mean, any kind of job that can be filled entirely by a keyword search of resumes is a job that's not going to last for very long.
Well, I spoke with a woman who her sole job at this electrical plant is to work with new hires, specifically engineers who come straight out of school. And she said, price is not the issue. We can hire the best talent based on grades. But her frustration, and this is her job, is to help them make the transition to working as a team in the organization. And I said, well, do you ever communicate this to the schools, to the colleges and universities? She says, all the time. But what they're focusing on is very left-brain skills in the engineering world. But what we need is they need to be able to come in and work as a team to solve problems quickly. And they're not teaching that, the whole idea of a team concept. So that's what her job is. Very interesting.
There you go. I mean, that itself is a very conceptual age job, because you can't imagine a way to outsource or automate that.
Right,
Very, very, it is a combination of both high touch, and then you have to be able to see the big picture. I mean, high concept, and then you have to be able to see the big picture and understand, the broader business imperatives of why you're doing this. But it's also very high touch, because you're dealing one-on-one with human beings.
Well, as we wrap up here, you mentioned that there are have three questions to ask if you're in business today. And the first one is, can someone overseas do it cheaper? And the second one, can a computer do it faster? And three, is what you're selling in demand in the age of abundance? Are there any other questions that people need to be asking as we, if you're in business today or working
in teams?
Well, I think
that those are the three questions that are very, very, very hard-headed analytical questions that people need to ask. I think the other one, which is in some ways sort of the meta question of all of it, is what do you love to do and what is your life about? Because I think that that the sorts of things, I think there's a growing congruence between the sorts of things that people do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation and the sorts of things that have some kind of economic value in labor markets. That is, you know, most people who become designers, who become storytellers or, you know, writers and so forth, they're doing it not to get rich, but because they love it. And that's not the case, I think, in many cases for accountants or lawyers. They're doing it because they're sort of marching down this path that they think they're supposed to be marching down. And so
I can hear my dad saying, "Here's what you need: good grades and a good job."
Right, and I think, and that's not, I think that's, that has been good advice. I think it's becoming more and more outdated advice. So I think that, you know, along with the other questions, what do you love to do and what are you great at? And I think if people devote their careers to stuff that they love to do and that they're great at, they're going to be fine regardless. So, I mean, take an accountant, okay? Someone who, the accountants that I worry about are these folks who don't really care about accounting one way or another, who's just a way to sort of phone in some work and get a paycheck each week. Those folks, their jobs are going to be outsourced or automated. I don't think there's any doubt about that. However, if there is somebody who loves accounting, who thinks that there is a poetry in getting the two sides of a balance sheet to come into alignment, who find the process of accounting fascinating, who find that, you know, advising companies or individuals on this stuff is enriching and fascinating and challenging, that kind of person is going to be fine. That person is going to be a great accountant. And that person is going to develop the sensibilities and the abilities and skills that will make him or her not immune, but at least somewhat protected from the forces of Asia and automation. But it's the folks who are doing things not out of a sense of intrinsic motivation who I worry about. And so, again, this is a very long-winded way of answering your sensible question, Tom. But the other question along with the three-part question that you outlined is, you know, what am I about, what do I love to do, and what am I great at?
Gosh, I imagine asking those questions at an early age. I think we'd end up with an entirely different society.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And one of the things that I think it's a very good point. And one of the things that I notice, again, not at a slightly older age, is that you go into a college, you talk to a college senior, particularly at sort of the more elite colleges, and you say, "Okay, so what do you love to do? What are you great at?" And often the answer is a look of utter befuddlement, and they respond, "Well, just tell me." I talked to a career counselor the other day at a university here in Washington, and she was saying that and it seems almost ludicrous. These kids come in and to the career office and say, "Okay, could I have the list of jobs?" You're like, "What list of jobs?" "Well, the list of jobs you're supposed to get." So they're not even thinking about what they want to do with their lives.
Oh my.
They're just kind of marching in lockstep. It's basically the, you know, it's the adult version of the question, is this going to be on the exam?
Right.
They're just looking for the answer, and they're not looking, they're looking very, very externally, and they ought to be looking internally, and no one has ever asked them to look internally. No one has ever asked them to look into their souls and find out what they love and what they're great at. And instead, they've been basically trained to march to this beat of extrinsic rewards and constantly pursue the extrinsic rewards and constantly do what they're supposed to do. As a result of that, this other side of their ability, has the other side of their soul in many ways, has been suffocated. And that's sad from a human perspective, but the dirty little secret is that it's actually potentially devastating from an economic perspective.
Wow. Well, how can our listeners find more about the work that you're doing?
Well, like everyone in America, Tom, I have a blog, and they can find it at www.danpink.com, and that also lists has a bunch of information about the book and a whole bunch of articles I've written, and also has contact information.
Fantastic. Danpink.com, and that link will be right next to this interview. Dan, I want to thank you for your time and writing such a great book.
Tom, thank you for that high praise, and thank you for a really fun, interesting interview. I really enjoyed it.
Well, fantastic. Well, I wish you success, and I'm going to be following your blog, like the rest of America would be following your blog. And this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com signing off. Thanks for listening.